Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Restoring Civic Education conference call. At this time, all participants are in listen-only mode. Later, we conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If you should require assistance during the conference, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference may be recorded. I would now like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Scott Jasik. Sir, you may begin.
Hello, I'm Scott Jasik, editor of Inside Higher Ed. Welcome to today's audio conference on college learning and democracy's future. College education, as you all know, serves many purposes, including enlightenment of various sources, training for careers, meeting new people and different kinds of people and being exposed to different perspectives. A recent report from the Association of American Colleges and Universities, A Crucible Moment, highlights the role of colleges in producing future citizens, people who will be engaged in the society in which we all live. Karen Musel of AACNU, who played a key role in the report, will today discuss the report's findings and how colleges can act on them. During the first half hour, Karen will lead us through a PowerPoint you all should have received. If any of you didn't receive it, please email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I'll get it to you right away. Shortly before the end of the presentation, we'll let you know how to ask questions, and then we'll have a Q&A. Karen, welcome.
Thanks very much, Scott, and thanks to those of you that are out in some sort of cyberspace that I cannot see, but I know that there are 55 of you, and I'm eager to hear you after I say a few comments to begin. I have begun this discussion on your PowerPoints with slide 2 and a quote by John Dewey, "Democracy needs to be born anew every generation, and education is the midwife." He understood and tried to create new ways that education could do the education for democracy. And I thought I would begin a context setting for this report with a quick reflection on my own life. Today is the groundbreaking, some of you may have read the stories or heard radio about this, the groundbreaking for the African American History Museum on the Mall here in Washington, D.C. And this was a moment in which the African American story is being inserted in geographic space from which it has been excluded largely up till now, though there is some visibility in some of the museums that exist. But it's a very important statement, and I wanted to tie that to my own story as an undergraduate at Duke University, where I went first went in 1962, and it was a moment when the nation was witnessing the most important, significant, and transformative democracy movement in our country's history during that session, interracial, intergenerational, happening in many states. And it is a movement, a civil rights movement, that never entered the campus where I was an undergraduate student. It was never discussed in classes, in dorms, even though the segregation and the reasons or the experience of shutting people out, some of our citizens out, was everywhere apparent. As a Northerner going down to Duke and riding on buses and having to suddenly shift to white-only waiting rooms, or going to the movie theater and seeing there were two places to sit, one if you were white and one if you were African-American, and witness my first KKK rally or in march during through the streets. I could look on that and have my own response to events, but no one at Duke gave me an historical understanding of what got this country to that moment, what the history of segregation had been. I never studied Reconstruction. We always studied Gettysburg and a battle, but not the aftermath and not enough about the content. So what the result of that was that I was not engaged or had no filter for understanding the roiling questions that were happening around me. So the real question for today, nearly 50 years later, the real question, in fact, I think it is 50 years later, is that right? Is what happens when education doesn't include the things going on in your world? This report is about people who've been working for a long time, decades, to bring the world's issues and problems and dilemmas onto our campuses, into our classrooms, into campus life, and into the scholarship that we are doing. The report was, you can see on chapter on slide 3, commissioned by the Department of Education. Though we had a full hand in doing it, and what we wrote is not necessarily representing their view. It was very much an independent thing, though in dialogue with them. And I think of it as a kind of people's document because it grew out of the insights of 150 of people who have devoted their professional lives to thinking about civic engagement and democratic engagement. And so they were really called to the table to talk about where we were, what kind of foundations had been laid, what did we know now about the impact on student learning, and what, most importantly, we could do and should do to make this learning more available to more students and to do a more influential job in the kind of questions that it raised and in its goal of creating engaged citizens in both their workplaces and in their communities. The next three PowerPoints, number 4, 5, and 6, are ones that were a kind of indicator. We kept coming across indicators of how we were doing in the U.S. There's many different sources that are recording this, and they're trying to track it along a number of different kinds of measurements. I've selected just 6 of them here, and I will just focus on 2 on slide 4. One, which is the measure often that we use for civic learning or civic engagement, is do people vote? And I was actually myself stunned to see how low we ranked in voter participation of the 172 world democracies, when in fact we are often looked to as the exporter of democracy. So that is a very unsettling comparative when we look at how we compare with the world. Then there is the question of the literacy level of people. What do they know about history, about civics, about how things work? And you really have only 24% of high school seniors scoring at the proficient or advanced level. That means three-quarters are scoring below proficiency, or let alone advance. We don't do much better when you turn to how our college students doing when they are given similar tests. Senior year students, where there is a group that does a civic literacy exam, and 50%, you know, fail. And so we are doing a little bit better than the 24%, but not much better. And only about a third of the students, and I think this is particularly strong in the PowerPoint number 6, that only a third of college students strongly agreed that their college education had made a difference in their civic awareness, their civic skills, and their civic commitment. So we have, I think we can say, oh good, we've made some difference somewhere. But we have a long way to go, and the challenge of this next decade, and I think the people that were looking at these figures, really set high ambitions. How do we reach the other two-thirds of students so that college education makes a difference in their civic awareness, their skills, and their commitment? All this totes up to the fact that there is a civic knowledge gap, a civic skill gap, a civic practice gap. So while higher education should be a resource for this, we haven't figured out how to do that. And this report is an effort to stimulate a focus on how we might structure what we know works to reach more people and to have a broader impact on the institution as a whole. Because we do have some evidence that higher education, when it does this work well, does have an impact on student learning. If you move over to PowerPoint 7, Charles Quigley, who is the executive director of the Center for Civic Education, I'm sort of focusing on the last sentence of that quote, because he calls it a civic recession. Some people talk about civic erosion. Some talk about civic crisis. We've called it a civic malaise at one point. But what he is essentially arguing is that to get out of this, to propel ourselves into more civil and useful and productive modes of discourse, to learn how to be quiet and listen and try to understand what someone who may have different opinions than you actually thinks and why, to work together to solve common problems that affect us commonly, and therefore we need each other involved. In order to get to that point, we will, as he says, need a full-scale national investment from every level of government and every sector of society. And this report focuses on recommendations that emerge from the field, from the people doing this work, watching this work, researching this work, studying it, measuring it. And they, too, are talking about a sense that this is everyone's business, that we need to work together. It has to be multi-sectored. It also has to be coordinated. And what we've tried to do is to provide some language that would also suggest a shared vision in which, though we will do our work more frequently in our own worlds, we will do it with a common vision of where we're going. So I've included in that slide that has no visible number, slide number 8, the cover of this volume, because it has the most important fact about this report on the top line. It is not meant to be a report that you read in your armchair and then file it alphabetically onto your bookshelf, but it is designed to be a report that will spur you, whoever you are, whatever location you are doing in or outside of higher education, ways in which you will feel compelled to act, because it is a national call to action. I will say that the focus of what we were to do was to focus on how to change and advance the work within higher education. So it is by no means comprehensive across the board, but we have really suggested ways in which we can't do our work in higher education without the cooperation of a lot of other sectors, whether that's local, municipal, local, national, or state governments, whether that is disciplinary societies, whether that are civic organizations that are working outside of us, that whether they are the accrediting people who are looking at the quality of what we do. There's a lot of people that influence the framing and the work and the incentives to work one way instead of another within college. So there are many constituents, and it will take all of us. I have included number 9, which is a quote from the Truman Commission, and if we had more time, I would say more about that commission. The most important fact to remember from it is it occurred at another crucible moment, right after World War II, when a group of higher education presidents, largely presidents, were appointed by President Truman to set an agenda for higher education for American democracy, 1947. I think there were 8 volumes. And there was a ringing sense that higher education, they listened to Dewey, the first and most essential charge, is that all levels and in all fields of specialization, higher education shall be the carrier of democratic values, ideals, and processes. It was an ambitious goal for 1947. It is one that made some differences in some pockets on our campuses, but it is a very powerful admonition, an inspiring legacy to reclaim and bring back into our generation to say, what would it mean to do this in 2012 in a world in which there are many more democracies than there were in 1947, in which they have many different faces, in which there is a much more integrated and interconnected world. So our countries, what happens in one part of the world reverberates around the rest. So what would this actually mean to do it in 2012? We begin by, and I wanted to just underscore, though AACNU published the report, it is really a report that represents the voices of the 150 people involved in the Civic Learning and Democratic Engagement Network. So we are just one of the organizations that is committed, as the many other organizations and individuals and colleges and universities to actually committing our resources to doing this work in the next decades. So we identified on slide 10 five essential actions that should be like an umbrella for the very specific and individual and particular work we do on a particular campus within student affairs, in the way we organize our reward structure, in our disciplinary societies, and the way in which we think about this. And I would just say that one of the first ones to say again and again, I think some of us who've been doing this work have been repeating number one for two decades at least. But we still, which is that we need to reinvest in the fundamental civic and democratic mission of schools and of all sectors within higher education, not just four-year, but also two-year, which is why a new network, the Democracy Commitment Network of community colleges that has said, yes, we are trying to open the career options for the students that come to our community colleges. We want more for them, and they want more for themselves than simply workforce development. That doing this work is not an indulgence, it's not a luxury, it's not an afterthought, but it is actually fundamental to why we're here, what our function is in a democracy, particularly a diverse democracy like ours, and it influences how we produce and advance knowledge and where we turn for expertise and where we practice that, and which is one of the reasons you'll see in this generation of work, the walls, the spaces of where higher education thinks and does its work has expanded beyond. If you went to Duke, and particularly the Women's College in my day, there were literal stone walls, and we were actually locked in our dorms at night during my day. Those doors are unlocked. Those walls have styles over them so we can get in and out and so people can do two-way traffic. I wanted to focus particularly on and just make a point about two other things on slide 10. One is about the importance of enlarging the national narrative. The other is about advancing the contemporary comprehensive framework for civic learning. And let me just begin with those two. And I will only put one slide number 11, which and I'm not sure how much this goes into the field, but it's very loud and clear here in Washington that most of the way, and I think because governors as well as the administration and even to some extent the Department of Education has been very good in a narrative that says we need to do completion and we need careers. And that's about as far as they go. What we were really saying is that this is not enough. It is not enough to simply complete college. That's an important thing. It is a important goal. I think everyone around the table that helped create this report believed that completion was one of the responsibilities in a diverse democracy, and that higher education needs to be better at its work in making sure all students thrive when they are at our institution and that their full talents blossom while they're there. But it isn't an either-or. It's not a matter of, well, you've either got to pick completion or citizenship, because one of the things our report tries to lift up is the correlation between, in this case, the research is almost exclusively on service learning, so it'd be good to expand beyond that, but that service learning is showing that being involved in service learning leads to the very same kind of outcomes that correlate with college completion. Academic engagement, higher grade points, deepening connections with faculty, feeling as if your work matters, as if it's about something, as it could be useful, all those things that are listed there, and I've added a few to it. So these are a both and in fact, they're complementary. People who are committed to completion should take a look at ways in which civic learning and democratic engagement can be a vehicle for raising those levels of completion. similarly, civic learning is not in opposition to careers, which is why we think that we need to think about completion careers and citizenship in this braided pair of three strands. Because what employers, as you can see on 12, are telling us is that many of the things that they want from higher education, wishes that we would place more emphasis on, are deeply connected to the kinds of learning you get when you are involved in these complex, messy, real-world issues around public consequences of things and how to work through and navigate through the differences among people about solutions to knotty problems. Whether that's critical thinking, whether that's ethical decision-making, problem-solving, intercultural competence, cultural diversity, they're all up there, and civic knowledge makes it onto the list. But those other ones are components of civic knowledge, which brings me to the other major recommendation, which is needing a more capacious, comprehensive view of what we mean by civic. One of those. Most typically when someone, and this happens to me a lot when they ask, what have you been working on for this past 9 months or year? And the minute I say civic learning, they think, A, it's about voting, and B, that the political scientists are doing it. And while those are both very important, the more comprehensive understanding of civic asks for much more. They are insufficient as the tools to negotiate the complexity of our local communities, of our more state communities, of our nation, and definitely of the world. So while we have similar words, knowledge, skills, values, and collective action, that in this contemporary world, we're going to pay more attention to things that I list on slide 14, that you need not only familiarity with democratic texts and democratic principles, but you need to also look at the debates, not only in the U.S., but in other societies, concerning the applications of those principles. The debates that happened from the beginning of the framing, that happened again in the 19th century and again in the 20th, and are being wrestled with today. Looking at democratic movements, not just the ones that are abroad. Heaven knows, I think many of us were spellbound watching the Arab Spring and what was happening in other countries. I had the great honor of being in South Africa shortly after apartheid ended, and it was inspiring to see ways in which democracy was made palpable. It mattered, and people understood that it mattered, and they valued their democracy, which made me want to come back to my own country with renewed commitment to reigniting that sense that it matters what we do. We've become, David Matthews worries that we're like a citizenless democracy, that we leave it to the experts, we feel sometimes disenchanted and disempowered or just disgusted, and we have to resist all of that. We are now in a world where it isn't just about my rights, but our rights and our world. And in diverse democracies, it is more important to invest in working toward a shared vision of what we mean, and that is a much more visible. We've always been diverse, but we now talk about that more. And I think our sense of interdependency is a much stronger felt experience and influences how we organize our societies. We also have, and this is probably a slightly newer dimension that sometimes you will see in definitions of what do you mean by civic learning or democratic engagement. You might see actions. How do you get a bill through? But this, we really emphasized in this report, collective action and what it means to address public problems, some of which are at the federal level and will involve lobbying and voting and organizing campaigns, and others that are very local, and some of them that are very much happening on a campus or in a dorm that are very particular. But in order to address those problems, how do you address them with and across diverse partners and deciding together what course of action to take? And I just heard someone talk about the decision of some students at Indiana University to organize a fair trade coffee campaign there and the variety of ways that they did it, the way they engaged with people, the way they sought their opinions, et cetera. So in this report, if you turn to 15, you'll see that there were four key recommendations for higher education. And we tried to pick big words that meant a lot of things, but could be remembered, because one of our first versions had probably 72 different recommendations. So we were trying to say, well, what does this add up to? What are the big concepts behind this? And that's where we came up with the civic ethos that would govern campus life, the very infusions of democratic values into the habits of everyday practices and structures that actually define the character of the institution to someone who walks onto the campus for the first time or that is a senior before, you know, afterwards. The second was making civic literacy a core expectation for all students, not just ones who go into public policy or want to do a nonprofit work or go into political science, but for all of us who will have responsibilities as citizens. The third one, the civic inquiry, is one where I think there is enormous room, a barely touched place to advance the work in higher education, which is really saying what are the civic dimensions and public consequences of a subject of study, of any subject of study, whether you're an engineer or you're going to become a nurse or you're going to become a business person, you're going to become a teacher. What are the civic dimensions of that that you need to think about and think about across differing points about that, and how could you describe and analyze those debates within one's major area of study? And the last one is civic action, certainly individual, but we were really focusing on what it meant to do civic action with others through transformative partnerships, both here and abroad, and I'll try and say a little bit about that. And I'm just going to say two more things. I'm going to skip over 16 and say with 17, and I'll finish 17, and then we'll break for Scott to tell you a little bit more about how to pose some questions. The good news in all of our research is that there's a really strong foundation at almost every college and university, a whole renewed focus outward, beyond, and trying to both move students out and bring people in and redefine the relationship of campuses to the places they immediately abut their communities, but also ways in which they're connected to the rest of the world. That's the good news. The bad news is that it's, at the moment, somewhat random. It's largely uncharted. It's as if we were so busy creating it, we generated lots of new programs, and it's not clear how one could move through them in more intentional ways and a progression of different introductions to aspects of civic and learning and democratic engagement, very complex and multifaceted skills and capacities to develop. And then most importantly, that it's optional. You can decide to take a particular course or not, or be involved in a particular kind of volunteer work or not. So what we'll turn to after Scott talks about how you can pose questions is some of the emerging designs of the 21st century civic learning on our campuses.
Thank you. Operator, could you please explain to our listeners how they can pose questions after the presentation?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touch-tone telephone.
Also, if you would like to ask questions but don't want your name or institution identified, you may email me at info@insidehighered.com, and I will read your question. If you indicate, I might say what kind of institution you're at, but I will not identify you or the institution. Karen, back to you to wrap up.
Okay. And I'll wrap up by just focusing on the slide 18, 19, and 20, because they represent a new architecture out. Both the first represents an architecture that's emerging that I think will give us a direction for embedding the work in much more effective ways than we've been able to do thus far and could be improved on. And the second will look at what we could call civic pedagogies, and the third really looks at collaborative partnerships. In the first one, around emerging architecture of the curriculum, we can see civic literacy getting embedded as a core expectation in general education. And we use the word pathways because the institutions we've lifted up, and these are all in more detail in the Crucible Moment, which is available online, as you know, and also in hard copy, if that's an easier way to look at it. But in all these cases, they offer an introduction to service learning or public engaged work in the first year or second. And then the student revisits this in another format in either junior or senior, typically connected to the student's major. So there is a sense of progression over time and through subject areas within general education. The civic inquiry is represented in the central field of study, whether that field of study is a two-year certificate or a two-year associate degree or whether that is in a four-year institution. And we've lifted up several places that have done that in very effective ways where the institutions that have created these programs, and in Worcester's case, all students go through all of these, and this is true with Tulane. Every student gets those two required courses. That's true at Portland State and at St. Edward's as well. So at Worcester, they'll start in freshman year wrestling with some big questions about feeding the world or healing the world or building the world, and they will move toward tying that to their major, where they're asked to say, how does my central area of study meet human and society needs? Then there are these pedagogies, and I think we could develop more, but I wanted to just name them. One has to do with how we talk with each other across differences. Very, very important. Some of these are in the curriculum and course base, like intergroup dialogues at University of Michigan. Some of them are deliberative dialogues, often in student affairs. In the sustained dialogue programs are student-run. Very important ways of learning how to listen and stay in conversation and be ready to alter, be informed by what people say rather than just waiting in turn for you to get the mic. Service learning is the most probably transformative of any of the pedagogies that has emerged. It continues to have the most profound effect. We study it the most, but by every, Sylvia Hurtado at Harry will say it just keeps coming out on top, I think because it layers many kinds of what are sometimes referred to as high-impact practices by doing the work, doing it with others, doing it in unfamiliar territory, having to invent and be creative, which leads us to the third powerful pedagogy, which is civic problem-solving, which we decided to, some service learning does this kind of pedagogy, but we decided to pull it out because it seemed to be generating its own more focused attention for people as they were trying to say it isn't a matter of only serving, it is a matter of acting and acting in concert with others to address issues. So not just serving, but solving issues together of common concern. And so you find programs at those three institutions that are really designed with that as the highest goal. And then the last I would end with is the way in which campuses are moving from a series of endless partnerships with institutions, with civic groups, usually not NGOs in their community or abroad, to cultivating those into more reciprocal generative ones where the community itself is actually determining the direction, and it is a collaborative between all parties who come together, and often it leads to a separate 501c3 that happened at Syracuse, and I forget where else I was just reading about where it happened as well. You find this new space that allows you to do this wonderful transformative work. Anchor institutions are playing that role in urban areas, partnering with hospitals and business and community groups in order to decide what and how to address some pressing needs in those communities. Which then leads us finally, I would just say, with the challenges of the next decade, which is a kind of reverse version of what's the bad news about what we have. The direction we hope to go is from elective to expected, from a one-time experience to progressive learning over time, from a more individually oriented civic action, something I do, I go vote, I write a letter, I go on a march, to collaboratively oriented action, from some faculty disciplines to all faculty, and from parallel practices and programs to much more integrated ones. And when we do that, we will be in the world of Terry Tempest Williams and W.E.B. Du Bois. I'll let you look at slide 23 as your words of inspiration. That is, it is about a democratic intellectual attributes we need, with open minds and risk-taking and being uncomfortable. And it is also about thinking about for what ends and how we can only achieve a perfect democracy when we have all of us at the table working for the shared ends that will enrich and empower all of us.
Thank you, Karen. That was a great overview of the report and what colleges can do. I have a few questions already in via email, but operator, could you again tell people how they can pose questions?
Yes, sir. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star, then one on your touchtone telephone.
I'm going to start off and exercise the moderator's prerogative and ask you a question that I've been thinking about related to the report. We hear a lot, this is an election year, and so you hear a lot of people talk about, will students vote? Are students politically active? I wonder if you could talk about the extent to which people view politics as the measure of civic engagement, and are there concerns that that's the only way some people define it?
Well, I think that is, in an election year, of course, it is a wonderful moment for having students look with a much more informed, critical, analytical capacity at what's being said about the world they live in and what makes sense and what doesn't and what's based on facts and what isn't. I do think that that people do think it is only politics, and I would like to say that it must also be politics, but it is. We have this election once every 4 years, or we vote every other year in an off-year election. So the voting in and of itself is a fundamental right, but it is a very limited understanding of what it would mean to engage democratically as citizens. So I think it is a wonderful moment, and some colleges are just exquisite in taking capitalizing on this, especially around deliberative dialogue, especially around naming big issues and doing research on them and seeing the solutions that people are creating and who those solutions help or don't help. So I think it's a potentially exciting impetus for bringing the public discourse onto the campuses, but it wouldn't suffice.
Okay, let me read. We have a question via email from a community college. I feel that one of the biggest deterrents in teaching civics to young adults is apathy. Students simply feel that their individual position will not have an influence on the country because they are a single voice with a single vote. What are some of the general causes for this position, and what approach can I take to reaffirm my students' positions as citizens in a democratic society?
I think that's a right-on comment and I think sometimes people are encouraged to feel apathetic. I sometimes felt as if I live in Washington, so, you know, I feel the attacks. I live inside the Beltway in Washington, even. And I have felt at certain times in my residency here, which has now been more than 20 years, that, you know, that people are trying to encourage people to think that it doesn't matter what happens here. And it doesn't. There's nothing they can do about what matters here. And I think that apathy is a deeply dangerous disposition for a democracy. And once you are apathetic, you've lost your democracy. So it is really it behooves us to figure out how to find out what issue would animate the students who might feel discouraged about one issue, but would they feel discouraged about another? And we have a lot of examples of students at their own initiative taking up issues that matter. There was a lot of student activism, political activism, at De Anza College and elsewhere in California when the budget cuts were coming down. They organized, they got buses, they went and testified to people in Congress, people at the state legislature, because it mattered to them that both their education and their brothers and sisters and other people's education would be limited because of the cutbacks, you know, with waiting lines to get into community colleges. So students find their issues. There have been lots of 7,000 came to Washington, I think, a year ago to both get trained and do work around global climate change. It's something that many students have taken as their issue. Others have taken sweatshop labor. What is the issue that is important, and how might your – I was just in a session at the Association of International Educators where several of the people there organized this woman doing a course on human rights said, you know, what is the issue that we should work on, you know, in our – social action project should we be doing. So the students were determining what that should be and how they could work on it collectively. Some people do that in smaller projects. Worcester Polytechnic does that. The students end up not being apathetic because they're I'll give the example of the Worcester Polytechnic freshman course. When they did one on healing the world, that was one of the possible things. A small group of students, everyone worked in these smaller groups, decided they would try to figure out how to get more information about vaccinations for, I'm trying to think whether it was tuberculosis or malaria. I apologize for my medical ignorance. But it would save lives, but people didn't want to get inoculated. They picked an issue enough cared about. They then examined what the causes culturally were. This was part of their assignment for the second half of their class. They then created solutions that they thought would work that would offset the cultural distrust that this is from a Western country and it's just going to poison them, that it violates religious restrictions on things entering your body, a whole series of things. And when they were done, they then presented their solutions to the class, one of which was to send their suggestions to the Minister of Health in India. Whether he ever did something about it, they felt empowered, and I think and very excited, and the students I heard presenting on this were articulate about it. And for some of the students, that then certain of these issues will become, more than a semester's thing. They will stay with it during the course. So I think it's a challenge to us to figure out how to ignite it, and one of the ways is to saying to students, what is it that you do care about? They'll tell you.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. We have a question from Casper College. Your line is open.
Thank you very much. We wanted to go back to slide number 4, and we had one of our participants that was most interested in how the data was gathered to come up with 24% of graduating high school seniors scored at a proficiency or advanced level in civics in 2010.
Sure. This is evidence from the NAEP civics test, the NAEP, that is offered. I don't know, I'm going to try to see whether it's every year or not, but it is regularly offered. So one of the unsettling things about those, because they do it periodically, is that there has not only been no progress since 1998, but there's been a decrease in these figures. So if you go to the PDF file and look at page 7, it will give you the reference for where that is.
Thank you so very much. I appreciate it.
Okay.
Another question in via email. What are your thoughts about serious national service requirements for all? Perhaps this could be envisioned as a 12 to 24 month service following high school graduation. Wouldn't this help our young adults to be aware of their responsibility for collective actions addressing local, national, global concerns?
This actually was one of the was a recommendation that came from the group. They wanted to they didn't go as far as national service, but they were talking about. I'll answer your question. Yes, I think that would be wonderful. I'll answer it, and could count in a number of ways. One of the things that came up from the group's thought thinking about it was how would you do a ROTC-like version for civic work. In other words, that you were training people to be publicly engaged. They got paid to do it. There was a set curriculum. They were committed to service, that it could be an access-enhancing program, as ROTC, as ROTC is. So I think that I think it would say something. You know, whether you could ever get that in the United States is I don't know, but I think it says it helps us create a civic ethos as a nation. This is what we care about. We care about contributing to each other, and each other matters. And that could be really salutary, given the level of divisiveness and ways in which we so easily demonize each other. So, and I do think that the support for the kind of programs, many of which have been zeroed out on budgets, that help get students out into the communities through the Corporation for National and Public Community Service, is one example of that, or Teach for America, those kinds of events, Peace Corps. And a lot of people think those aren't important and should be zeroed out.
Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Christopher Hollowell. Your line is open.
Yes, I was wondering, in a career-driven curriculum where professors are sort of obligated to teach certain materials, what mechanisms can be used to engage the faculty in civic engagement, in teaching civic engagement?
I think that one of the important things that, and it's a recommendation actually in Chapter 3 of the report, which is really, saying every department ought to talk to each other about what the civic and public what the civic inquiries that were most urgent to explore in their field. So to really turn to the departments, not to impose it on them, but to say, you're a history major. What are those public questions? You're going into nursing. You're going to become an engineer. You're going to be a manager. What are the public purposes of those respective fields? And I think our failure to do that, and there's some evidence that certain majors depress the civic urges in students so that there is a drop in it as they're in school longer. When in fact, that our failure to do that has led, I would argue, I guess someone could challenge whether there's evidence for this, to some of our worst national scandals. That there was no one thinking of the civic consequences when they were busy making money with subprime mortgages and organized a whole industry to operate only about money and only about getting extraordinary wealth and only about doing really good business. It was irresponsible business because it didn't really ask about the public consequences, which we are seeing in heartbreaking story after heartbreaking story. Same thing with the Enron scandal, that you are, to misuse someone's funds like that and to rob people of their retirements. I mean, whose moral consciousness was asleep or who was told to check them when they went into work And in fact, you know, if we are really helping people have a sense of their civic identity connected to the civic professionalism of their work as an accountant or as an engineer or as a teacher, that we would be raised, have more people ready to raise more questions in the workplace that would create a stronger, fairer, more just democracy. And I think that there is definitely a role. I think we just haven't asked it. I mean, some majors have, but everyone has public consequences of whatever your area of study. It probably does mean, and this would be the big debate, that some things will push off to the side, that you won't, it's sort of like you can't cover biology anymore in one volume, so you decide what it is you can cover. But to think that we should feel as if our students are educated when they don't have this as a component of whatever their career profession, I think will leave our country ultimately bankrupt, and we don't, in more than money.
Thank you. Actually, we have another question via email that relates to what you trade off. This is from a private college. I love the idea of starting a student's program with the big questions and moving into specifics within a student's program. However, how do you do this if students lack a basic understanding of our own government, let alone other global governments? Must you do both?
Well, I mean, I think there's no... There's no better way to learn about one's government than a big question where they keep stumbling across what the country has or has not had to do, what the governmental, political, if I'm reading the question right, and please get back to me if I'm not, that you know, if you really wanted to attend to I'm just trying to think of, I'll use climate change because I've used it before. If one of the big questions is how do we move towards sustainability as a planet, then the student is going to learn about the science, perhaps in regard to the, you know, shrinking number of waters or the pollution of water, and then you begin to look at the issue of fracking and what fracking has to do with putting some water at risk, and who's going to decide whether fracking happens or not, how does that work, and you then suddenly discover there are, you know, how lobbying works in our country, how corporations position themselves, what local communities do to organize to say not here or not anywhere. I mean, so these big questions can often lead you to very, very specific insights into how things work in this one instance, which then lets you have some glimpse of how it's going to work in other instances. So I think when students are fired up about a question, it's a little bit like learning a language. My daughter, and I think this is true, when you know you're going to use that language, you're about to go to this country, your motivation for learning it is very, very high, and you work really hard at it. If it's, you know, to fulfill a requirement and you can't imagine that you'll ever use it, you know, you're a little more lackadaisical. So I think the big questions is a great way to spur the imagination, and then, you know, get behind the big questions.
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Wilkes College Community. Your line is open.
Yes, I have a question. I noticed that we had some of the biggest advances in democracy starting around 1932 and pushing into the mid-70s, and that coincided, of course, with the Depression and people's need to engage. Today, of course, we have almost a reverse situation where people feel like they're sliding backward, and we have this feeling of backward momentum. How do we recapture that 1932 moment to make democracy more urgent?
Well, you know, you're often more urgent when you're in crisis, and that's why we picked the crucible moment as the title. I think you're absolutely right that this is a period of crisis here, and there are a lot of pressures on our democracy, a sense that it could break apart, like the crucible that holds the ores, that under the intense heat they can be burnt up or they can be transformed into something that is usable and in an entirely new fashion. So I do think that we really we really should use this moment where there is some agreement across many groups of many different political persuasions and many different locations in the society that we are in trouble, that our democracy, some people will say, is broken or isn't serving everybody well or isn't really offering the same economic opportunity to everyone. And one way to reclaim it is to reclaim it, is to become engaged in trying to make a difference, heal it, figure out what broken piece a particular group of people might fix or might help improve. For some people, that's economic inequalities. For other, it's unsolved racial tensions. For other, it's immigration issues. For other, I mean, it varies with the person. Some people are trying to get campaign money, you know, out of our elections. We certainly failed on that one. So I think that the sense that there is a shared problem will help focus positive energy in trying to think of positive ways. And I think you're sort of looking at moments where we move forward would really be instructive. I mean, it's like Reconstruction for a while, you know, was an amazing rewriting of American democracy's promissory note, and then it reverted back to essentially a white supremacist organization like it was before the war, a country before the war. But we can really look at these moments where we move forward, where we opened up access. The 47, it led to community colleges. It led in 1940, I think there were only 5% of Americans had degrees. So what happened in that century was this amazing democratization of higher education. And we're now, some of that is at threat. So how do we figure out what made it all work and what new strategies might get us on the right track again?
Thank you. Operator, could we have the next question in the queue, please?
Thank you. Our next question comes from Illinois State University. Your line is open. Pardon me, Lindsay Dixon. Your line is open. One moment,
well,
please.
Well, if not, let me read another question that we've got via email. Slide number 12 claims that employers want employees who have civic knowledge and awareness, and I agree. But isn't it largely because corporate-led initiatives to privatize universities that many of our institutions are reticent to become involved in community and world affairs?
Read the last part again.
Isn't it largely because corporate-led initiatives to privatize universities that many of our institutions are reticent to become involved in community and world affairs?
That doesn't sound like a convincing argument to me, and it might be that I just haven't understood that. And my apologies to the questioner. I certainly think that we do have a lot of not-for-profits. For-profit institutions, that's the fastest-growing sector, if that's that is offering education to more students, and it is also the one that gets them in the deepest debt. I think that there are very few institutions that don't have corporate money of some kind, and increasingly state universities get so little money from states, some of them down to 10% of their support is coming from states, that they are fundraising wherever they can, and some of that is corporate. So, and research is often corporate, as well as state and federal funds. So all of us are in this hybrid mix, and I don't think that has kept people from being involved in the though I don't know whether for-profits are actually, my sense is that this is not the sector in which you will find a lot of civic engagement work embedded.
It
shouldn't be.
Let me just get in one more question also via email. And this is somebody who says it's fine to identify him as a assistant professor of political science from Dalton State College. Do you think that the focus that colleges tend to have on focusing on civic issues separately, specifically an American-focused course separated from the international focus courses has been detrimental to the overall goal of creating engaged and involved democratic citizens, and does this approach need to change on college campuses?
I think that's a very interesting question, and I think I would probably, whether it's kept us from being civic, I think it's given us an inaccurate view of the world. I think it, in other words, there is probably not a moment in American history or its decisions. I began with the civil rights movement. That was played out against the Cold War. Martin Luther King knew it. He took advantage of that. The Russians were trying to attract the newly emerging African nations and saying, you want to align with us, not with those people that put dogs and hoses onto their citizens, onto their black citizens. So, you know, there is this backdrop context for, and more than context sometimes, that influenced American history. So I think it would certainly give students a better sense of the interconnectivity of things if, when they're reading about the globe, America's in that, or our involvement in that, or ways in which we are connected to what we think of as happening out there, and that we understand ways in which America has always been a nation among nations, and from our Revolutionary War on was you know, decided in part by the global connections we had with other nations, and inspired in some sense by some of the documents, both in England and in France. So I think it, it's a both and I think there are some exciting courses that St. Edward's weaves back and forth between the global experience. They start the American experience in Africa, for instance, when they do their American experience. So thank you. That was a very good question.
Well, that's all the time we have for questions today. To our audience, you will all receive an evaluation, and I hope you'll fill it out and offer suggestions for future audio conferences. Thank you for your thoughtful questions, and thank you, Karen, for sharing your expertise. Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude today's conference. Thank you for your participation, and have a wonderful day. You may now disconnect.